Simon & Schuster Audio presents 1776 by David McCullough. Read by the author.
Part 1, The Siege. The reflection upon my situation and that of this army produces many an uneasy hour, when all around me are wrapped in sleep. Few people know the predicament we are in. General George Washington, January 14, 1776. Chapter 3, Dorchester Heights. We are not under the least apprehension of an attack on this place by surprise or otherwise. General William Howe. That Dorchester Heights could decide the whole outcome at Boston had been apparent to the British from the beginning. Their initial plan, agreed to on June 15th, had been to seize the high ground on both the Charlestown and Dorchester peninsulas. But then the rebels had made their surprise move at Charlestown, digging in overnight on Bunker Hill, and it had taken the bloodbath of June 17th to remove them. The morning after the battle, in a council of war at the Province House, headquarters of the Commander-in-Chief, Thomas Gage, it was proposed by Major General Henry Clinton to move immediately on Dorchester. Possession of the Heights was absolutely necessary for the security of Boston, as they lay directly on our water communications and more seriously annoyed the port of Boston than those of Charlestown, Clinton later wrote, adding that he expected to lead the assault. I foresaw the consequence, and gave it formally as my opinion at the time, that if the King's troops should ever be driven from Boston, it would be by rebel batteries raised on those heights. But while Gage had kept Bunker Hill heavily armed with cannon and manned by 500 troops, he had done nothing about Dorchester, nor had General Howe since taking charge after Gage's departure for home in October, nor indeed had the Americans. Dorchester Heights remained a kind of high, wind-blown no-man's land, neither side unmindful of its strategic importance, but neither side daring to seize and fortify it. Among those loyalists in Boston who had closest contact with the British command, it was commonly understood that Dorchester was the key and commonly questioned why nothing was being done. It had often been wished, wrote Justice Peter Oliver, one of the most prominent loyalists, that this hill had had proper attention paid to it, and it had been repeatedly mentioned that it was of the last necessity to secure such a position. But the general answers were that there was no danger from it, and that it was to be wished that the rebels would take possession of it, as they could be dislodged. Of greater and more immediate interest to the British command was the prospect of abandoning Boston altogether, of packing up and sailing away. As things stood, it was clearly no place to launch an offensive operation. New York should be made the seat of war, Gage has stressed in correspondence with the administration in London, and Howe and the others were of the same opinion. Brigadier General James Grant had said months earlier that Boston should be abandoned while there was still time. We cannot remain during the winter in this place, as our situation must go on worse and that of the rebels better every day, Grant had insisted in a long letter from Boston to Edward Harvey, Adjutant General of the British Army in London, on August 11th. Grant, a grossly fat, highly opinionated Scot who had served in the French and Indian War, had an extremely low opinion of Americans. It was he who had boasted to Parliament that with 5,000 men he could march from one end of the American continent to the other. The only step that made sense, he wrote, was to burn Boston and move on to New York. Besides, he wanted to turn the fleet loose to burn every principal town along the New England coast. Lenity is out of the question. Such were the delays in communication across the ocean that by the time General Howe received orders from London to abandon Boston before winter and remove the troops to New York, it was too late. Winter had arrived. Besides, there were too few ships at hand to transport the army and the hundreds of loyalists about whom Howe was greatly concerned, knowing what their fate could be if they were left behind. Seeing no reasonable alternative, Howe would wait for spring, when he could depart at a time and under conditions of his own choosing. he expected no trouble from the Americans. "We are not under the least apprehension of an attack on this place from the rebels by surprise or otherwise," he assured his superiors in London, and further stressed the point at a meeting with his general staff on December 3rd. "Should, however, the rebels make a move on Dorchester, then," Howe affirmed, "we must go at it with our whole force." Quite unlike the man in command of the army encircling the town, the British commander was not impatient for action. On the contrary, William Howe had little inclination ever to rush things. Further, it was taken as a matter of course among professional soldiers that winter was no season for campaigning. And so the British army settled in for a long Boston winter, seeing to their comforts as best they could under the circumstances. The notable exception was Major General John Burgoyne, Gentleman Johnny, an officer of distinguished record and occasional playwright, who had added welcome color to the social life of the British officers and their ladies. Impatient with supineness, as he said, and ambitious for a command of his own, Burgoyne had sailed for England in early December. Winter in America was a trial British soldiers could never get used to, any more than they could adjust to the incessant clamor of frogs on spring nights, or American mosquitoes, or the absence of decent beer. The harsh winter winds and driving snows of the Bay Area inflicted misery indiscriminately on both armies, of course. But for the King's men, unaccustomed to such a climate, the punishment was all but unbearable. A young Irish nobleman, Captain Francis Lord Rawdon, wrote of the suffering of his men encamped on Bunker Hill in early December. Their tents so shattered they could as well have slept on the open ground. And we hear with some envy of several little balls and concerts which our brethren have had in Boston. Soldiers froze to death standing watch. Even when the troops moved to winter quarters a few weeks later, keeping warm seemed nearly impossible. The open sea remained the only lifeline for fuel and food for the town. But with the severity of storms on the North Atlantic, and American privateers operating offshore in increasing numbers despite the weather, fewer and fewer supply ships were getting through. "The rebels have the impudence to fit out privateers," wrote an indignant British officer, snug in his quarters. "But the day would come," he knew, "when we shall give the scoundrels a hearty thrashing and put an end to this business." British Admiral Samuel Graves, whose responsibility it was to patrol the coastline against privateers, described snowstorms at sea between Cape Ann and Cape Cod as defying the most resolute of men. "This sort of storm is so severe that it cannot even be looked against, and by the snow, freezing as fast as it falls, baffles all resistance. For the blocks become choked, the tackle encrusted, the ropes and sails quite congealed, and the whole ship before long one cake of ice. Indeed, if the severity of the winters be such in this climate that the sentinel on shore is frequently found frozen to death upon his post, though relieved every half hour, the reader may frame some idea of what the seamen of a watch, especially in small vessels, must suffer." With firewood selling for $20 a cord in Boston, more and more trees were cut down, including the old elm at the corner of Essex and Orange Streets, known as the Liberty Tree, which provided 14 cords. 100 or more houses were pulled apart. Old barns, old wharves, and derelict ships were chopped up, almost anything that would burn. On orders from General Howe, Old North Church was demolished for firewood. Only a fraction of Boston's former peacetime population remained, thousands having long since fled the town. But others, Loyalists, had sought refuge there. And Loyalists were conspicuous, if not necessarily more numerous, than those inhabitants who had chosen to stay in the hope of protecting their property or because they were too poor or helpless to do anything else. A few, like the town's selectmen, had been forbidden to leave. In all, there were now about 4,000 civilians under siege, at least half of whom were women and children, and they too, no less than the Redcoat Army, were hurting from shortages of all kinds, the poor inevitably suffering the most. Food remained extremely scarce and dear. Young Lord Rawdon described his famished troops as looking like skeletons. even inferior cuts of horse meat brought good prices. To put a stop to increasing instances of plunder by the troops, Howe initiated punishments more severe even than the standard for the British Army. In fact, the new year of 1776 began in Boston with the public whipping of a soldier and his wife who had been caught with stolen goods. For the British officers, however, the red-coat gentry, as Washington called them, life was not entirely unpleasant. They had appropriated Old South Church for a riding ring, Old South Church being odious to them because town meetings had been held there. Pews were torn out, dirt spread on the floor. According to the diary of Deacon Timothy Newell, one particularly beautiful hand-carved pew was taken away to serve as a hogsty. Evening entertainments were numerous. "We have plays, assemblies, and balls, and live as if we were in a place of plenty," wrote an officer. "In the midst of these horrors of war, we endeavor as much as possible to forget them," explained the wife of another officer in a letter to a friend at home. Writing again to General Harvey, James Grant said, "We must get through a disagreeable winter the best way we can. I do all in my power to keep the ball up. I have all ranks of officers at dinner. Give them good wine. Laugh at the Yankees and turn them into ridicule when an opportunity offers." A dispatch rider dismounted at Washington's headquarters, carrying the worst news of the war thus far. It was a letter from General Schuyler at Albany. The army Washington had sent across the Maine wilderness under Benedict Arnold to attack Quebec had been defeated. Arnold was badly wounded. General Richard Montgomery, who with 300 men had joined in the assault, attacking from Montreal, had been killed. Help was urgently needed. How many others had been killed or wounded at Quebec, how many taken prisoner, no one yet knew. Washington, as he wrote privately, often felt that the eyes of the whole continent were on him, fixed with anxious expectation. When the Council of War convened again the first thing the next morning, it was reluctantly concluded that given the present feeble state of the army, no troops could be spared for Quebec. The single glimmer of hope was confirmation from Schuyler on January 18th that the guns from Ticonderoga were on the way. As it happened, Colonel Knox, who had ridden on ahead, reached Cambridge later that same day. Knox had been gone for 2 months, and he had fulfilled all expectations, despite rough forest roads, freezing lakes, blizzards, thaws, mountain wilderness, and repeated mishaps that would have broken lesser spirits several times over. He had succeeded with his bold, virtually impossible idea, and at exactly the right moment, justifying entirely the trust Washington had placed in him. The story of the expedition would be told and retold for weeks within the army and for years to come. Departing from Cambridge on horseback on November 16th, Knox and his brother William had traveled first to New York City, where they made arrangements for military supplies to be sent back to Boston, then pressed northward up the Hudson Valley, at times making 40 miles a day. They arrived at Fort Ticonderoga on December 5th. Built by the French at the start of the French and Indian War in 1755, the limestone fort had been taken by the British in 1759, then by the Americans in May of 1775. It stood at the southern end of Lake Champlain, where Lake Champlain meets the northern end of Lake George. The guns Knox had come for were mostly French, mortars, 12- and 18-pound cannon, that is, guns that fired cannonballs of 12 and 18 pounds, and one giant brass 24-pounder. Not all were in usable condition. After looking them over, Knox selected 58 mortars and cannon. Three of the mortars weighed a ton each, and the 24-pound cannon more than 5,000 pounds. The whole lot was believed to weigh not less than 120,000 pounds. The plan was to transport the guns by boat down Lake George, which was not yet completely frozen over. At the lake's southern end would begin the long haul overland, south as far as Albany, before turning east toward Boston across the Berkshire Mountains. The distance to be covered was nearly 300 miles, Knox planned to drag the guns on giant sleds and was counting on snow, but thus far only a light dusting covered the ground. With the help of local soldiers and hired men, he set immediately to work. Just moving the guns from the fort to the boat landing proved a tremendous task. The passage down Lake George, not quite 40 miles, took 8 days. 3 boats and their immense cargo set sail on December 9th, and for the first hour had a fair wind. After that, progress came only with the utmost difficulty. Indeed, from Knox's hurried, all but illegible diary entries, that first hour on the lake appears to have been the only hour of the entire trek that did not bring the utmost difficulty. One of the boats, a scow, struck a rock and sank, though close enough to shore to be bailed out, patched up, and set afloat again. Knox recorded days of heavy rowing against unrelenting winds, 4 hours of rowing exceeding hard one day, 6 hours of excessive hard rowing on another. In places the boats had to cut through ice. Knox's brother William wrote at day's end December 14th of beating all the way against the wind. God send us a fair wind. Nights ashore were bitterly cold. It is not easy to conceive the difficulties we have had, Knox wrote to Washington at the end of the voyage on the lake, in a letter of December 17th that would reach Cambridge only about the time he did. On his way north to Ticonderoga, Knox had arranged for heavy sleds or sledges to be rounded up or built, 42 in all, and to be on hand at Fort George at the southern end of Lake George, about 35 miles south of Ticonderoga. "I most earnestly beg you to spare no trouble or necessary expense in getting these," he had told a local officer. With the sleds and 80 yoke of oxen, he was now ready to push on. "Trusting that we shall have a fine fall of snow, I hope in 16 or 17 days to be able to present Your Excellency a noble train of artillery." To his wife, Knox claimed the most difficult part was over, and speculated, "We shall cut no small figure through the country with our cannon." Still, there was no snow. Instead, a cruel thaw set in, halting progress for several days. The route south to Albany required 4 crossings of the Hudson. With ice on the river so thin, the heavy caravan could only stand idly by at Fort George and wait for a change in the weather. When the change came, it was a blizzard. 3 feet of snow fell, beginning Christmas Day. Determined to go ahead to Albany on his own, Knox nearly froze to death, struggling through the snow on foot, until finding horses and a sleigh to take him the rest of the route. Eventually, the precious convoy pushed off from Fort George. "Our cavalcade was quite imposing," remembered John Becker, who at age 12 had accompanied his father, one of the drivers on the expedition. They proceeded slowly, laboriously, in the heavy snow, passing through the village of Saratoga, then on to Albany, where Knox was busy cutting holes in the frozen Hudson in order to strengthen the ice. The idea was that water coming up through the holes would spread over the surface of the ice and freeze, thus gradually thickening the ice. On New Year's Day, the weather turned warm again. "Precious time was wasting," he wrote to Lucy. "The thaw has been so grave that I've trembled for the consequences, for without snow my very important charge cannot get along." But the temperature plunged again. On January 7th, General Schuyler wrote to Washington from his Albany headquarters, "This morning I had the satisfaction to see the 1st Division of sleds with cannon cross the river." They moved cautiously over the ice, and for several hours it appeared that Knox's holes had done the trick. Nearly a dozen sleds had crossed without mishap, until suddenly one of the largest cannons, an 18-pounder, broke through and sank not far from shore, leaving a hole in the ice 14 feet in diameter. Undaunted, Knox at once set about retrieving the cannon from the bottom of the river, losing a full day in the effort, but at last succeeding, as he wrote, "owing to the assistance of the good people of Albany." On January 9th, the expedition pushed on from the eastern shore of the Hudson, with more than 100 miles still to go. Snow in the Berkshires lay thick, exactly as needed, but the mountains, steep and tumbled and dissected by deep, narrow valleys, posed a challenge as formidable as any. Knox, with no prior experience in such terrain, wrote of climbing peaks from which we might almost have seen all the kingdoms of the earth. It appeared to me almost a miracle that people with heavy loads should be able to get up and down such hills, reads another of his diary entries. To slow the descent of the laden sleds down slopes as steep as a roof, check lines were anchored to trees. Brush and drag chains were shoved beneath the runners. When some of his teamsters, fearful of the risks, refused to go any further, Knox spent 3 hours arguing and pleading until finally they agreed to head on. News of the advancing procession raced ahead of the lead sleds, and, as Knox had imagined, people began turning out along the route to see for themselves the procession of the guns from Ticonderoga. "Our armament here was a great curiosity," wrote John Becker of the reception at the town of Westfield. "We found that very few, even among the oldest inhabitants, had ever seen a cannon." Becker, at age 12, had never known such excitement. "We were the great gainers by this curiosity, for while they were employed in remarking upon our guns, we were, with equal pleasure, discussing the qualities of their cider and whiskey. These were generously brought out in great profusion." At Springfield, to quicken the pace, Knox changed from oxen to horses, and on the final leg of the journey the number of onlookers grew by the day. The halt came at last about 20 miles west of Boston at Framingham. The guns were unloaded, Knox meantime having sped on to Cambridge. Knox's noble train had arrived intact. Not a gun had been lost. Hundreds of men had taken part, and their labors and resilience had been exceptional. But it was the daring and determination of Knox himself that had counted above all. The 25-year-old Boston bookseller had proven himself a leader of remarkable ability, a man not only of enterprising ideas, but with the staying power to carry them out. Immediately, Washington put him in command of the artillery. To those who rode out from Cambridge to Framingham to look over the guns, it was clear that the stalemate at Boston was about to change dramatically. There was a perceptible quickening of activity at the big gray house that served as headquarters. The pace of the commander's correspondence, the numbers of post riders and uniformed officers coming and going, gave evidence of something in the offing. "My business increases very fast from great changes," Washington wrote to Joseph Reed, without providing details. Reed's help was needed more than ever. "It is absolutely necessary to have persons that can think for me as well as execute orders." The strength of the army was still deficient, the situation so serious, Washington confided, that he was obliged to use art to conceal it, even from his own officers. That he was about to take action could be read easily enough between the lines of this and other correspondence that went speeding off in the pouches of fast mail riders. The camps were alive with rumors and speculation. "Great activity and animation are observed among our officers and soldiers, who manifest an anxious desire to have a conflict with the enemy," wrote the ever-perceptive Dr. James Thatcher, who predicted either a general assault on the town of Boston or the erection of works on the heights of Dorchester, or both. The bitter cold continued. On January 27th, the thermometer dropped to 4 degrees. The low on January 28th was 1 degree, then 2 degrees on January 30th. Yet cold as it was, there was still no ice bridge sufficient to carry an army. Some mornings Washington went to the bay to jump up and down on the ice himself, to test its strength. He made a personal reconnaissance of the approaches to Dorchester, even to the heights apparently, accompanied by several of his officers, including Henry Knox. According to one possibly apocryphal account, Washington and the others had left their horses and were proceeding on foot when suddenly 2 mounted British officers, coming at a gallop, sent them running and scampering for life. A week later, a British raiding party crossed the ice to Dorchester and burned several farmhouses. On February 16th, Washington convened his council of war for what he hoped would be unanimous agreement that the time had come to attack. A stroke well aimed at this critical juncture might put a final end to the war, he argued. Perhaps a greater question was never agitated in a council of war, wrote General Gates of the meeting. And whatever art Washington may have exercised to conceal the truth of the Army's strength from his officers, there was, in fact, little that Gates and the others gathered in the room were not aware of. For weeks, the demonstrative Israel Putnam had been bewailing the need for gunpowder. "Old Putt would not relent," wrote one of Washington's staff. "He is still as hard as ever, crying out for powder. Powder, ye gods, give us powder." Conspicuous by his absence was Nathaniel Greene, who'd been stricken with jaundice. "He was as yellow as saffron and so weak that I can scarcely walk across the room," he had written to his brother, to whom he also gave his own opinion on the proposed attack. The very thought filled him with dread. An assault on a town garrisoned with regular troops could have horrible consequences, Greene wrote. Horrible if it succeeded, and still more horrible if it failed. The Council of War marked the fourth time Washington had called for approval for an attack on Boston. And once again, wisely, the generals said no. Very likely, the shattering defeat at Quebec had reinforced the view that any assault on so heavily defended a position was not worth the terrible risk. There was, however, agreement to another plan. Instead of striking at the enemy where they were well fortified, they would lure the enemy out to strike at them, as had been done at Bunker Hill. From the accounts of spies and British deserters, it was by now known that Howe had sworn he would sally forth if ever the Americans tried to occupy Dorchester. And so it was resolved that preparations begin with a view of drawing out the enemy. Washington was crestfallen over the decision not to attack. "Behold, though we had been waiting all the year for this favorable event, the enterprise was thought too dangerous," he wrote to Joseph Reed. But perhaps he had been wrong, he gracefully conceded. "Perhaps the irksomeness of my situation led me to undertake more than could be warranted by prudence." But all that was done with. The issue was now at an end, and I am preparing to take post on Dorchester. From this point on, there would be no holding back. The preparations were elaborate and mammoth in scale, and Washington threw himself into the effort, demanding that not an hour be lost. Intelligence reports that the British intended to evacuate Boston at first chance did nothing to deter him. Twin hills comprised the heights of the Dorchester Peninsula, and the distance from these summits to the nearest British lines at Boston Neck was 1.5 miles, well within the range of a 12- or 18-pound cannon. The distance to where most of the British fleet lay off Long Wharf was greater, almost 2 miles, which was also within range, though barely. The plan was to occupy the heights on a single night, before the British knew what was happening, just as had been done at Bunker Hill. This time, however, there were the guns from Ticonderoga to haul in place, and the heights of Dorchester were considerably steeper than at Bunker Hill, and at an elevation of 112 feet, nearly twice as high. More seriously, the frozen ground on top was impenetrable as a rock, in Washington's words, which meant that digging trenches and throwing up breastworks in the usual fashion would be impossible, at least in one night and with no noise. The solution was a highly sophisticated scheme whereby the fortifications would be fabricated elsewhere out of sight, then, with massed manpower and oxen, hauled along with the heavy cannon to the heights of Dorchester, where all would have to be in place and ready for action before daylight. A resourceful lieutenant colonel who had directed the work on the fortifications at Roxbury, Rufus Putnam, a farmer and surveyor in normal times and a cousin of Israel Putnam, had suggested the idea after seeing an unfamiliar term in a text on artillery, Muller's Field Engineer, by a British professor named John Muller. Putnam had taken his plan to his superior officer, Colonel Richard Gridley, and to Henry Knox. In turn, the three had gone to see Washington, and in no time hundreds of men were at work building chandeliers, great timber frames that could be filled with screwed hay, hay twisted into bales, or compact bundles of branches and brushwood called fascines. Washington also wanted barrels filled with earth set in rows in front of the parapets to add to the appearance of strength, but more importantly, to stand ready to be rolled down the steep slopes on the advancing enemy. He had a very high opinion of the defense which may be made with barrels, he told Artemus Ward, stressing that the hoops should be well nailed so the barrels would not break to pieces. To divert the enemy and drown out the noise of the work parties, Washington planned to precede the operation with night barrages of artillery fire from Roxbury, Cobble Hill, and Leechmere Point, where a number of guns from Ticonderoga had been newly emplaced. As critical and dangerous as any part of the operation would be the crossing of the low-lying causeway of the Dorchester Peninsula, which stood in plain view of the British lines at the Boston Neck, less than a mile away. To conceal all movement over the causeway, an extended barrier of hay bales was to be thrown up. 3,000 men under General Thomas were to take part in fortifying the heights. Another 4,000 were to stand by at Cambridge for an amphibious attack on Boston once the British launched their assault on the heights. Amphibious because milder weather had returned and the bay was again largely open water. General Putnam had overall command of the Boston attack. Generals Greene and Sullivan would lead the crossing. On the Charles River at Cambridge, 60 flatboats stood ready. To bring the army to maximum strength, 2,000 Massachusetts militia were called out, while work details were dispatched to round up wagons, carts, and 800 oxen. At the Army's hospital in Cambridge, thousands of bandages were being prepared, and additional beds made ready. Notices in the Boston Gazette, published in Watertown since the start of the siege, called for volunteer nurses. For miles around Boston, everybody seemed to know someone or someone who knew someone who was in the know about what to expect. Bets were wagered on what would happen and when. In the surrounding towns, tension and fear grew by the day. "It is generally thought that there will be something done amongst you very soon," Sarah Hodgkins wrote from Ipswich to her husband Joseph. "The preparations increase and something is daily expected. Something terrible it will be," wrote Abigail Adams to her dearest friend, who had since returned to Philadelphia. "I have been in a continual state of anxiety and expectation. It has been said tomorrow and tomorrow for this past month, but when the dreadful tomorrow will be, I know not." As he had often before in his life, Washington eased the stress of waiting by catching up with his correspondence, writing again to Joseph Reed and to a young black poet, Phyllis Wheatley, then living in Providence, who had sent him a poem written in his honor. "Proceed, great chief, with virtue on thy side. Thy every action let the goddess guide." The country had no poets as yet, and Washington was not known to be inclined to poetry or poetic musings. Yet he, a soldier and planter, a slave master, despite all that bore heavily on his mind, took time now to write her in his own hand. "I thank you most sincerely for your polite notice of me," Washington wrote, "and however undeserving I may be of such encomium and panegyric, the style and manner exhibit a striking proof of your great poetical talents. Should she ever come to Cambridge, he would be happy to see a person so favored by the muses." In a letter to a Virginia friend, Washington wrote almost lightly of preparing to bring on a rumpus with the Redcoats. The date had been settled. The move on Dorchester would begin after dark on March 4th and be completed by first light the morning of March 5th, the anniversary of the Boston Massacre. How many hundreds, perhaps thousands, understood what was unfolding, even in some detail, no one knew. Yet success depended on secrecy. To this end, Washington ordered a stop to all communication with Boston. Generals Heath and Sullivan personally inspected the lines to verify the vigilance of the guards on duty. on the chance that the enemy got wind of what was happening and moved first to occupy the heights, certain regiments stood ready to march at a moment's notice. One of the closest observers of the situation within Boston, Loyalist Peter Oliver, would later write that there was not the least suspicion of what the rebels were up to. But according to the diary of one British officer, a few of the British did find out as early as February 29th, from deserters and from a spy referred to only as Junius, that the rebels intended to bombard the town from Dorchester. The warnings, however, were not taken seriously. Washington issued orders to the troops, clarifying how very serious the moment was and what was expected of them. As the season is now fast approaching, when every man must expect to be drawn into the field of action, it is highly necessary that he should prepare his mind, as well as everything necessary for it. It is a noble cause we are engaged in. It is the cause of virtue and mankind. Every temporal advantage and comfort to us and our posterity depends upon the vigor of our exertions. But it may not be amiss for the troops to know that if any man in action shall presume to skulk, hide himself, or retreat from the enemy without the orders of his commanding officer, he will be instantly shot down as an example of cowardice. On the evening of March 2nd, Washington wrote in haste to Artemus Ward that everything must be set and ready to go as planned on Monday night, March 4th. After folding and sealing the note, he scrawled on the back, "Remember Barrels." The bombardment of Boston began at midnight Saturday and continued at intervals until morning. The British answered at once with a heavier, louder cannonade. "The house shakes with the roar of the cannon," wrote Abigail Adams at her home 10 miles away. "No sleep for me tonight." Little damage was done by the exchange. It was nearly all noise, just as Washington wished, and the night would have been reckoned a complete success were it not that three of the big mortars burst, due apparently to the inexperience of Henry Knox and his artillerymen. Sunday night the firing resumed, and again the British responded with full crescendo. On the third and crucial night of Monday, March 4th, the roar of guns from both sides became more furious by far. British Captain Charles Stewart described sheets of fire filling the sky, but he also recorded the inhabitants were in a horrid situation, particularly the women, who were several times drove from their houses by shot and crying for protection. Watching from the American lines, Lieutenant Samuel Webb wrote, "Our shells raked the houses, and the cries of the poor women and children frequently reached our ears." At the first crash of the guns, General Thomas and 2,000 men started across the Dorchester Causeway, moving rapidly and silently, shielded from view by the long barrier of hay bales. An advance guard of 800 men, a covering party, made up largely of riflemen, went first to fan out along the Dorchester shores in case the British made any attempt to investigate during the night. The main work party of 1,200 men followed immediately after, and then came hundreds of carts and heavy wagons loaded with chandeliers, fascines, hay bales, barrels, and most important of all, the guns from Ticonderoga. The whole procession moved on in solemn silence and with perfect order and regularity, while the continued roar of cannon serves to engage the attention and divert the enemy, wrote Dr. Thatcher, who, crossing the causeway with the troops, noted with gratitude the vast number of large bundles of screwed hay arranged in a line next to the enemy, to which we should have been greatly exposed while passing. Progress up the steep, smooth slopes was extremely difficult, yet numbers of the ox teams and wagons made 3 and 4 trips. The night was unseasonably mild, indeed perfectly beautiful with a full moon, ideal conditions for the work, as if the hand of the Almighty were directing things, which the Reverend William Gordon, like many others, felt certain it was. "A finer night for working could not have been taken out of the whole 365," he wrote. "It was hazy below the heights, so that our people could not be seen, though it was a bright moonlight night above on the hills. At Cambridge, on the moonlit common, Generals Greene and Sullivan paraded with 4,000 troops in front of the college buildings, ready to move to the river and the shallow draft boats in the event of a signal from the Roxbury church steeple. Recounting the night's events later, General Thomas would say it was as early as 10 o'clock when the fortifications on the heights were sufficiently ready to defend against small arms and grapeshot. It was also about 10 when a British lieutenant colonel, Sir John Campbell, reported to Brigadier General Francis Smith that the rebels were at work on Dorchester Heights. It was news that called for immediate action, but Smith, a stout, slow-moving, slow-thinking veteran of 30 years' service, chose to ignore it. And from that point on, the work proceeded unnoticed by any other British officers or troops on guard, or by any of the Loyalists in Boston who served as willing eyes and ears for the British. On the heights, men toiled steadily with picks and shovels, breaking the frozen ground for earth and stone to fill the chandeliers and barrels. At 3 in the morning, a relief force of 3,000 men moved in, and an additional 5 regiments of riflemen took up positions near the shore. By the first faint light before dawn, everything was ready, with at least 20 cannon in place. It was an utterly phenomenal achievement. General Heath was hardly exaggerating when he wrote, "Perhaps there never was so much work done in so short a space of time." At daybreak, the British commanders looking up at the heights could scarcely believe their eyes. The hoped-for, all-important surprise was total. General Howe is said to have exclaimed, "My God, these fellows have done more work in one night than I could make my army do in 3 months." The British engineering officer, Archibald Robertson, calculated that to have carried everything into place as the rebels had, a most astonishing night's work, must have required at least 15,000 to 20,000 men. Howe, in his official account, would be more conservative and put the number at 14,000. Later that spring, one of the London papers would carry portions of a letter attributed to an unnamed officer of distinction at Boston. 5th March. This is, I believe, likely to prove as important a day to the British Empire as any in our annals. We underwent last night a very severe cannonade, which damaged a number of houses and killed some men. This morning, at daybreak, we discovered 2 redoubts on the hills of Dorchester Point and 2 smaller works on their flanks. They were all raised during the night, with an expedition equal to that of the genie belonging to Aladdin's wonderful lamp. From these hills they command the whole town, so that we must drive them from their post or desert the place. The shock of discovery threw the British into utmost consternation. Their immediate response, a thunderous 2-hour cannonade, proved nothing, as their guns could not be elevated sufficiently to strike a target so high. Meantime, from his flagship, Admiral Molyneux Sholdham, who had replaced Admiral Graves, sent an urgent, unequivocal message to William Howe. Not a ship in the harbor could remain unless the rebels were removed from their position. It was not that the ships were directly under the guns on the heights, as some later accounts gave the impression. At such a distance of nearly 2 miles, a direct hit would be a lucky shot. Still, the ships were theoretically within range, and lucky shots were known to happen. Howe could dally no longer. With his generals gathered at the Province House at mid-morning, he made his decision. He would attack, as he had vowed he would, and as his pride and honor demanded. He had no intention of staying in Boston, but that now seemed beside the point. Being who he was, he could not possibly accept the prospect of being outdone by the ragtag enemy, even if the carnage that had resulted from such an attack at Bunker Hill was as well known to him as to any man alive. 2,000 troops were ordered to proceed by ship down the harbor to Castle Island, from where the attack on Dorchester would be launched at nightfall. Captain Archibald Robertson thought the plan little short of madness and said so to others. Writing in his diary during the course of the day, he called it the most serious step ever an army of this strength in such a situation took, considering the state the rebels' works are in and the number of men they appear to have under arms. The fate of the whole town was at stake, not to say the fate of America. These were his sentiments, he declared, and he listed the names of the officers he had spoken to, hoping they could persuade Howe to change his mind and embark from Boston as quickly as possible. But starting about noon, the big transports loaded with troops began pushing off from Long Wharf. Years later, recalling the morning of March 5th on Dorchester Heights, John Trumbull would write, "We saw distinctly the preparations which the enemy were making to dislodge us. The entire waterfront of Boston lay open to our observation, and we saw the embarkation of troops from the various wharves. We were in high spirits, well prepared to receive the threatened attack." Dr. Thatcher, setting events down in his journal as they unfolded that anxious day on the heights, wrote of the swarms of spectators covering the nearby hills, waiting to see a bloody battle. Sometime in the course of the day, the exact hour is not known, Washington arrived to survey the defenses and the panorama below. His Excellency General Washington is present, animating and encouraging the soldiers, recorded Thatcher, and they in return manifest their joy and express a warm desire for the approach of the enemy. "Each man knows his place and is resolute to execute his duty," he continued. "Our breastworks are strengthened, and among the means of defense are a great number of barrels filled with stone and sand, arranged in front of our works, which are to be put in motion and made to roll downhill, to break the ranks and legs of assailants as they advance. These are the preparations for blood and slaughter. Gracious God, if it be determined in thy providence that thousands of our fellow creatures shall this day be slain, let thy wrath be appeased, and in mercy grant that victory be on the side of our suffering, bleeding country." According to Reverend William Gordon, Washington called on those within the sound of his voice to remember it is the 5th of March, and avenge the death of your brethren. It was immediately asked what the general said by those who were not near enough to hear, and is soon answered. "And so from one to another through all the troops, which added fresh fuel to the martial fire before kindled." Describing the troops drawn up at Cambridge, waiting for the order to attack, Washington himself said he never saw spirits higher. It was about noon when the first of the British troop transports pushed off for Castle Island, and proceeded down the harbor with increasing difficulty against strong headwinds. For by early afternoon, what had been an abnormally warm, pleasant day had changed dramatically. The wind had turned southeasterly, blowing pretty fresh. Then, as foreseen in no one's calculations, the elements took over. By nightfall a storm raged, with hail mixed with snow and sleet. By midnight the wind blew almost a hurricane. Windows were smashed, fences blown over. Two of the transports bound for Castle Island were blown ashore. The American Lieutenant Isaac Bangs, who was among those freezing at their posts on the high ground of Dorchester, called it the worst storm that ever I was exposed to. Clearly there would be no British assault that night. The morning after, the winds continued to blow with a fury. The snow and sleet had changed to driving rain. General Heath concluded that kind heaven had stepped in to intervene, as so it seemed to many on both sides when, that morning, Howe called off the attack and gave orders to prepare to evacuate Boston. Possibly it was not the storm alone that caused Howe's change of mind. According to Captain Robertson, his pleas to cancel the attack, and the influence of the other officers to whom he had made his case, and John Montresor in particular, had had the desired effect even before the storm reached full force. From what Robertson wrote in the final lines of his diary entry for the day, it would seem that the storm had merely given Howe an easy out. It is now 8 o'clock in the evening. We went to headquarters at 7. After waiting some time, Captain Montresor came down from the general and told me he had been in council and had advised the going off, embarking altogether, that Lord General Hugh Percy and some others seconded him, and that the general said it was his own sentiments from the first, but thought the honor of the troops concerned. So it is agreed immediately to embark everything. Interestingly, Isaac Bangs, in his account of the day, wondered whether the intent of the whole British expedition to Castle Island was never anything more than to make a parade, and if the storm was only a good excuse. In the view of General James Grant, however, there was never a doubt of Howe's desire to attack. Indeed, we had often talked over the subject and agreed that if the rebels made that move to their right, to Dorchester, we must either drive them from that post or leave Boston. According to Grant, everything had been prepared, and the plan to attack was immediately formed, the redoubts to be stormed by troops in column, and not to load, that they might be under an absolute necessity of making use of their bayonets. Howe, in his own official account, was to say, "I determined upon an immediate attack with all the force I could transport." He added, "The ardor of the troops encouraged me in this hazardous enterprise." And this could be the explanation, though an American who saw the British troops waiting on the wharf to embark commented that they looked in general pale and dejected, and said one to another it would be another Bunker Hill or worse. Howe made no mention in his official account of the Council of War convened at 7 o'clock, or of any second thoughts on his part. The contrary winds of the afternoon of March 5th, the storm that followed that night, and the weather continuing boisterous the next day and night, were the deciding factors, Howe wrote, in that they gave the enemy still more time to improve their defenses of the heights. "I could promise myself little success by attacking them under all the disadvantages I had to encounter. Wherefore I judged it most advisable to prepare for the evacuation of the town." No one who was in Boston would forget the days that followed. In less than 48 hours, the supposedly invulnerable security of the town had dissolved. Howe's army and the fleet at anchor were in danger of being destroyed at any time. The very survival of the town itself was in question. In conference and in dispatches to London, the general had stated repeatedly his confidence that the rebels would make no move. Now he and his vaunted regulars had been outsmarted by the rabble in arms, whom they had so long disparaged and despised. Instead of victory, they faced the humiliation of ignominious retreat. "Never were troops in so disgraceful a situation," wrote one officer. "I pity General Howe from my soul." Almost from the moment Howe made his announcement the morning of March 6th, ordering the army and fleet to prepare to leave, Boston became a scene of utmost frenzy. "Nothing but hurry and confusion, every person striving to get out of this place," wrote an American merchant, John Rowe. Deacon Timothy Newell, who, like John Rowe, was a patriotic American, had been forbidden, as a town selectman, to leave Boston. This day, he wrote on March 6th, "the utmost distress and anxiety among the refugees and loyalists. Blessed by God, our redemption draws near." Howe, who had received no orders, no word of any kind, from London since October, had no long-standing plan for a withdrawal of such magnitude, or any comparable past experience to draw upon. "I told General Howe," wrote James Grant, "that I had been in many scrapes, but that I never was in so thick a wood, with all the branches like thorns, but that we must look forward and get out." It was not just that there were thousands of troops and military stores to transport, but the hundreds of women and children who were with the army. Further, Howe intended to take every loyalist who chose to go. The necessary care of the women, sick and wounded, required every assistance that could be given, one man wrote. It was not like the breaking up of a camp, where every man knows his duty. It was like departing your country, with your wives, your servants, your household furniture, and all your encumbrances. It seemed everyone had his own dire needs or urgent special request, someone or something to complain about, someone or something to blame for his plight. There were a sufficient number of transports and other ships at hand, but these all had to be supplied with provisions and water. Equipment of all kinds had to be put aboard. In the meantime, there was very little to eat. Continued storms at sea had prevented nearly all supply ships from even approaching the coast. When a single sloop from the West Indies did make it into the harbor, it was learned that more than 70 food transports, victuallers, and store ships that had been blown off course that winter were tied up and refitting at Antigua. According to some rumors, there was not enough food left in Boston to last 3 weeks. High winds kept blowing, churning the harbor, and the rebel guns remained silent. But while the rebels held their fire, they could be seen in plain view on Dorchester Heights, steadily strengthening their position. All was still comparatively quiet on Friday, March 8th, when Deacon Newell and three other selectmen crossed the lines at the neck under a white flag, carrying an unsigned paper stating that General Howe had no intention of destroying the town unless the troops under his command are molested during the embarkation. Though clearly intended for Washington, this declaration was not addressed to him, and so it was given no reply. But the word had been passed. If allowed to depart peacefully, the British would spare the town. Then the night of March 9th, when the rebels were seen moving on to Nook's Hill on Dorchester, a high point of land only a quarter of a mile from the British lines at the neck, Howe ordered a thunderous all-night bombardment. "Such a firing was never before heard in New England," wrote Isaac Bangs. 4 men were killed by a single ball, but that was the only damage done. The next day, the men on the hill gathered up 700 cannonballs that had been fired at them. In town, the pell-mell rush and confusion grew worse. The cathartic was drastic, as Loyalist Peter Oliver observed. Hogsheads of sugar and salt, barrels of flour, for which there was no room on the ships, were being dumped into the harbor, along with smashed-up furniture, wagons, wheelbarrows, even the commander's elegant coach. Cannon, for which there was no room, were spiked or dumped in the harbor. Americans watching from a dozen hillsides and promontories around the town could see, as Washington wrote, "streets full of great movements and confusion among the troops, night and day, in hurrying down their cannon, artillery, and other stores to the wharves with utmost precipitation." Washington was convinced that Howe was making ready to sail for New York. The alarm and anxiety among the Loyalists was extreme. Leave they must, but no one knew how many there were, or whether there would be room for all, or where they were heading. Not until the morning of March 10th were they told they could begin coming aboard. There was no time for deliberation. Virtually all they owned would have to be left behind. Those who were already refugees, those who had earlier fled Cambridge, Roxbury, or Milton for the presumed safety of Boston, knew what it was to abandon everything and find themselves dependent on charity. Now Bostonians, too, faced the prospect of forsaking lifelong associations and treasured belongings. Indeed, their very homeland and entire way of life. It is not easy to paint the distress and confusion of the inhabitants on the occasion. I had but 6 or 7 hours allowed to prepare for this measure, being obliged to embark the same day, wrote the Reverend Henry Caner. As the rector of King's Chapel, the first Anglican church in Boston, the Reverend Caner was the leading Episcopal clergyman in Massachusetts and a greatly respected figure among all denominations. He had been rector for nearly 30 years and lived alone in a small frame house close to King's Chapel at the corner of School and Tremont Streets. In his account of goods left in my house at Boston, March 10, 1776, he listed, among other items, a handsome clock, 2 mahogany tables, teacups and saucers, 1 rich carved mahogany desk and bookcase with glass doors, pictures of the king and queen, under glass with rich frames, a pair of brass andirons, a fine harpsichord, 1,000 books, a barn and appurtenances, a cow and a calf. The great majority of the Loyalists had never lived anywhere else or ever expected to live anywhere else. They were disillusioned, disoriented, and not a little resentful. In their allegiance to the king and to the rule of law, they saw themselves as the true American patriots. They had wanted no part of the rebellion, the horrid crime of rebellion, Justice Oliver called it, and had trusted, not unrealistically, in the wealth and power of the British nation to protect them and put a quick end to what, by their lights, had become mob rule. A Boston merchant named Theophilus Lilly, who owned a store on Middle Street specializing in English dry goods and groceries, had expressed his view in print in the aftermath of the mob assault on British soldiers that erupted into the Boston Massacre. "Upon the whole, I cannot help saying, although I have never entered into the mysteries of government, having applied myself to my shop and my business, that it always seems strange to me that people who contend so much for civil and religious liberty should be so ready to deprive others of their natural liberty. If one set of private subjects may at any time take upon themselves to punish another set of private subjects just when they please, it's such a sort of government as I never heard of before. And according to my poor notion of government, this is one of the principal things which government is designed to prevent." Dr. Sylvester Gardner, one of the best-known men in town, would write to a son-in-law, "I found I could not stay in Boston and trust my person with a set of lawless rebels whose actions have disgraced human nature and who have treated all the king's loyal subjects that have fallen in their hands with great cruelty, and for no other crime than for their loyalty to the best of kings and a peaceable submission to the best constituted government on earth. I don't believe there ever was a people in any age or part of the world that enjoyed so much liberty as the people of America did under the mild, indulgent government, God bless it, of England, and never was a people under a worser state of tyranny than we are at present." It was said the fleet was bound for Halifax in Nova Scotia, but no one could say for certain. And who knew in any event what miseries lay in store for them at sea? Many who wanted desperately to escape had families they were loath should be separated. Many who chose to stay did so knowing they could expect ill usage at the hands of the rebels. Conspicuous among those who began crowding the wharves and who took their turns going aboard the ships on March 10th, and in the days that followed, were many who had once figured prominently in the government of the province and in its professional and commercial life. There were leading churchmen like Henry Caner, jurists like Peter Oliver, physicians, educators, and successful merchants. The elderly Nathaniel Perkins was Boston's foremost physician. John Lovell was headmaster of the Boston Latin School. Attorney James Putnam of Worcester had been John Adams's mentor in the law. Foster Hutchinson, jurist and merchant, was the brother of the former royal governor of Massachusetts, Thomas Hutchinson. General Timothy Ruggles, a veteran of the French and Indian War, was a wealthy landowner and outspoken Tory who had been put in command of three companies of loyal American associators, as they were known, who had helped patrol the streets during the siege. John Murray and Harrison Gray were prosperous merchants. A score or more were Harvard graduates, and many were fourth or fifth generation Americans bearing some of the oldest names in the province, such as Coffin and Chandler. Benjamin Faneuil, who was departing with a family of three, was the nephew of wealthy Peter Faneuil, whose many benefactions to Boston had included Faneuil Hall. These were people of wealth and position among the conservative element of Massachusetts, people of distinction by and large, as well as power. But prominent though they were not the majority of those departing with the fleet. Ultimately, 1,100 Loyalists went aboard the ships, and the greater part were from every walk of life: shopkeepers, clerks, minor customs officials, artisans and tradesmen and their families. According to one study, 382 heads of families were farmers, mechanics, and ordinary tradesmen. William McAlpine, printer and bookbinder, declared his first and chief objective was to convey his wife in safety to Scotland. Among the women listed as heads of families was Hannah Flucker, the mother of Henry Knox's wife Lucy, with a household of six. Thomas Flucker, Lucy's father, appears to have departed earlier. Margaret Draper, who joined the Exodus with a family of five, had continued to publish the Loyalist newspaper, the Massachusetts Gazette, and Boston Newsletter, after her husband's death in 1774. It was the only newspaper available in Boston during the siege. Also listed was Dorcas Griffith, who ran a notorious waterfront grog shop and was known to be John Hancock's discarded mistress. Joshua Loring, Jr. was another of those departing, along with the rebel prisoners he was charged with looking after. But his handsome wife, Elizabeth, is not accounted for, suggesting she may have been provided with more comfortable accommodations aboard the flagship Chatham with General Howe. Many of the crowd were elderly. The Reverend Caner and Dr. Perkins were in their 70s, and many more were children or infants. William Hill, a baker who had supplied bread for the British troops, went aboard with a family of 17. Accommodations on the crowded transports and other ships were wretched. Foster Hutchinson and his large family were assigned to steerage. Wealthy Benjamin Halliwell found himself sharing a cabin with 36 others. Men, women, and children, parents, masters, mistresses, obliged to pig together on the floor, there being no berths, until they left the harbor. Appraising the situation, the royal governor of New Hampshire, John Wentworth, hired a schooner to sail with the fleet and pack 50 people on board. In the next few days, the ships with loyalists began falling down the harbor with the tide as far as King's Road, below Castle Island, to anchor out of range of the rebel cannon, and to provide space for other vessels to tie up at the wharves. And there the exiles sat, rocking with the tide day after day. On March 10th, Howe had issued a proclamation ordering inhabitants to give up all linen and woolen goods that could be of use to the enemy, and assigned a man named Crean Brush, one of a Loyalist corps, to see that the order was carried out. "Sir," Brush's official commission read, "I am informed there are large quantities of goods in the town of Boston, which, if in the possession of the rebels, would enable them to carry on the war. And whereas I have given notice to all loyal inhabitants to remove such goods from hence, and all who do not remove them or deliver them to your care will be considered abettors of the rebels, you are hereby authorized and required to take into your possession all such goods as answer this description, and to give certificates to the owners that you have received them for their use, and will deliver them to the owner's order, unavoidable accidents excepted. And you are to make inquiry if any such goods be secreted in stores, and you are to seize all such." In effect, Brush, remembered later as a conceited New York Tory, was authorized to take whatever he wanted in return for worthless certificates. And once he and his men began plundering the town, gangs with axes, drunken soldiers and sailors, rampaged in the streets, breaking open houses and shops at will. "There never was such destruction and outrage committed any day before this," wrote merchant John Rowe. On a visit to Rowe's wharf and warehouse, Brush and his men made off with goods worth more than 2,000 pounds. "Soldiers and sailors plundering," wrote Deacon Newell on March 13th. "Same as above," he recorded the next day. On March 15th, Newell and the other selectmen were summoned to the province house and told the army would embark that day, and that it would be wise for all remaining citizens to stay in their houses. If there were any interference with the king's troops, Howe warned, he would burn the town. But the wind proved unfavorable for departure. Not until Sunday, March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, did the wind turn fair and favorable. The troops began moving out at 4 in the morning. More than 8,000 redcoats marching through the dark, narrow streets of Boston as if on parade. By 7, the sun was up, and ships thronged at the wharves began lifting sail. By 9 o'clock, all were underway. "Fine weather and fair wind," wrote Major Stephen Kemble, a loyalist serving with the British. "The finest day in the world," wrote an exuberant Archibald Robertson. It was a spectacle such as could only have been imagined until that morning. There were 120 ships departing, with more than 11,000 people packed on board. 8,906 King's troops, 667 women, and 553 children, and in addition, waiting down the harbor, were 1,100 Loyalists. "In the course of the forenoon," wrote James Thatcher, "we enjoyed the unspeakable satisfaction of beholding their whole fleet under sail, wafting from our shores the dreadful scourge of war. People on shore were cheering, weeping. Surely it is the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes," wrote Abigail Adams. But then the whole fleet came to anchor at King's Road, and with the arrival of General Howe's flagship, Chatham, every ship of war fired a roaring 21-gun salute, and the full 50 guns of the Chatham answered in kind, an ear-splitting reminder of royal might. The first cheers from the American lines had been heard as early as 9 that morning, when the men on Prospect Hill and Dorchester Heights saw clearly what was happening. In no time, small boys came running across the neck from Boston to deliver the news that the lobster backs were gone at last. Puzzled that British troops appeared still to be manning the fortifications on Bunker Hill, even as the fleet was getting underway, General Sullivan mounted his horse and cantered off for a closer look, only to discover that they were hay dummies set up by the fleeing redcoats. It was early afternoon when the first troops from Roxbury, 500 men who had already had smallpox and were thus immune, crossed the neck and marched into Boston, drums beating, flags flying, and led by Artemus Ward on horseback. By all rights, it should have been Washington who made the triumphal entry. But in a characteristically gracious gesture, he gave the honor to Ward, the thorough New England man, who had been his predecessor as commander and the first and most persistent in favoring a move on Dorchester Heights. Though how much this may have figured in Washington's decision is impossible to know. Washington remained at Cambridge, where he attended Sunday services conducted by the chaplain of Knox's artillery regiment, the Reverend Abiel Leonard of Connecticut, who chose for his text Exodus 14:25. "And they took off their chariot wheels, that they drove them heavily, so that the Egyptians said, Let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fighteth for them against the Egyptians." Washington rode into Boston the following day, Monday, March 18th, and took a close look at the place for the first time, after 8.5 months of studying it through the lenses of his telescope, almost every day, in every kind of light, and from every possible angle. He came without fanfare. His purpose, as he reported to Congress, was to appraise the damage done and see what the enemy had left behind. The town, although it had suffered greatly, was not in as bad shape as he had expected, he wrote to John Hancock. "And I have a particular pleasure in being able to inform you, sir, that your house has received no damage worth mentioning." Other fine houses had been much abused by the British, windows broken, furnishings smashed or stolen, books destroyed. But at Hancock's Beacon Hill mansion all was in order, as General Sullivan also attested. And there was a certain irony in this, since the house had been occupied and maintained by the belligerent General James Grant, who had wanted to lay waste to every town on the New England coast. "Though I believe," wrote Sullivan, "the brave general had made free with some of the articles in the wine cellar." The last desperate efforts of the British to destroy whatever could be of use to the Americans were in evidence everywhere: spiked cannon, shattered gun carriages and wagons. Ships left behind at the waterfront had been scuttled, their masts cut away. And as Dr. Thatcher noted with concern, smallpox was lurking still in several parts of town. But the surprise for Washington was how much had not been destroyed or carried off, so great had been the chaos and rush of the enemy in the last days. An inventory of British goods compiled by Thomas Mifflin, now the Quartermaster General, listed 5,000 bushels of wheat at Hancock Wharf, 1,000 bushels of beans, and 10 tons of hay at the town granary, 35,000 feet of good planks at one of the lumber yards. There were more than 100 horses left by the British. Indeed, there was nearly everything that was needed but beef, gunpowder, and hard money. Washington estimated the total value at perhaps £40,000, but after further examination, that figure would be raised to £50,000. The other surprise was the strength of the enemy's defenses. The town was amazingly strong, almost impregnable, every avenue fortified, he wrote. But if this gave rise to any second thoughts about his repeated desire to send men against such defenses, or the wisdom of his council of war in restraining him, Washington kept such thoughts to himself. Just as he had shown no signs of despair when prospects looked bleak, he now showed no elation in what he wrote or in his outward manner or comments. On March 20th, Washington put Nathanael Greene temporarily in command of the town, while he returned to Cambridge to concentrate on his next move. Certain that Howe intended to sail for New York, he had already sent 5 regiments in that direction. But with the British fleet still hovering below Castle Island, he dared not send more, and worried now that Howe's withdrawal might be a trick, that the plan was to come ashore somewhere near Braintree and double back to outflank Dorchester and Roxbury. On the night of March 20th, Boston and the whole South Shore were rocked by a tremendous explosion when British engineers Montresor and Robertson blew up Castle William. The morning after, in heavy snowfall, Howe's fleet dropped still further down from the town to anchor in Nantasket Road off Braintree. Those on board the ships were as puzzled by Howe's intentions as anyone. "We do not know where we are going, but are in great distress," one loyalist wrote. They had been cooped up now in the harbor for nearly 2 weeks. One man, racked with despair, threw himself overboard and was drowned. But to most on board, any destination would be welcome after what they'd been through. You know the proverbial expression, "Neither hell, Hull, nor Halifax can afford worse shelter than Boston," wrote an officer in description of the prevailing mood. At last, on March 27th, 10 days after the evacuation of Boston, the fleet was again under way, and this time heading for the open sea. When several Loyalists gathered at the rail of one of the ships, expressed confidence that they would be returning soon in triumph, a prominent Boston merchant, George Irving, turned and said solemnly, "Gentlemen, not one of you will ever see that place again," words long remembered by the 5-year-old son who stood beside him. Merchant Irving had sided with the Loyalists primarily because he thought the rebellion would fail, but the success of Washington's army at Boston had changed his mind, as it had for many. By day's end, the fleet had disappeared over the horizon, bound not for New York, but for Halifax. Fast riders carried the news to Providence and Newport, Hartford and New Haven, New York, Philadelphia, then on to Maryland, Virginia, and the Carolinas, and Georgia, 1,100 arduous miles from Boston. For all who believed in the American cause, it was the first thrilling news of the war. The joy of our friends in Boston on seeing the victorious and gallant troops of their country enter the town almost on the heels of their barbarous oppressors was inexplicably great, reported the New Haven Journal. The British, said the New York Constitutional Gazette, were completely disgraced. Free men under arms had triumphed, with all the world watching, and in the admirable and beloved Washington the country had a hero, as the citizens of Philadelphia and members of Congress read in the Evening Post of March 30th. To the wisdom, firmness, intrepidity, and military abilities of our admirable and beloved general, His Excellency George Washington, Esquire, to the assiduity, skill, and bravery of our other worthy generals and officers of the army, and to the hardiness and gallantry of the soldiery, is to be ascribed under God the glory and success of our arms, in driving from one of the strongest holds in America so considerable a part of the British Army. Congress ordered a gold medal struck in Washington's honor. The disinterested and patriotic principles which led you to the field have also led you to glory, read a formal letter of gratitude. Those pages in the annals of America will record your title to be a conspicuous place in the temple of fame, which shall inform posterity that under your directions an undisciplined band of husbandmen in the course of a few months became soldiers. What an occurrence is this to be known in Europe, wrote Elbridge Gerry of the Massachusetts delegation in Congress. How are parliamentary pretensions to be reconciled to facts? What was especially wondrous was that the British had been driven from Boston by only about a 30th part of the power of America.